All right, so get ready to dive into some physics. Today we'll be exploring the world of motion, specifically how objects move along a straight line, one-dimensional motion.
Exactly.
And to help guide us, we've got a chapter from a physics textbook, but don't worry, we're not going to get lost in all the equations and technical stuff.
No.
We're going to pull out the most interesting parts, the things that make physics so fascinating. Like, did you know that understanding how, say, a car accelerates on a straight road can actually help you understand things like planetary motion?
Oh, absolutely.
Or even how tiny electrons move around atoms? It's all connected.
It is, it is.
And the chapter starts by talking about the idea of models in physics, which basically means simplifying things, right?
Yeah.
Like, imagine studying the Earth going around the sun. Well, we can actually treat the Earth as if it were just a tiny dot.
Right, like a particle.
A particle, exactly. Obviously, the Earth is not a dot.
No.
But this simplification helps us wrap our heads around how it moves. And that's what this chapter focuses on, the particle model, where we analyze movement as if objects are just points moving along a line.
And it's a really powerful approach because it allows physicists to study the motion of anything
Oh, wow.
from, like you said, a planet orbiting a star to an electron buzzing around the nucleus of an atom.
That's so cool, like a universal tool. Okay, so let's move on to some specific concepts. The chapter delves into position and displacement, using a car moving back and forth on a straight road as an example.
And what's interesting is that they present the same information about the car's position at different times in three different ways:
Oh, okay.
a table, a diagram, and then a graph.
So it's like seeing the same story from different angles.
Precisely. And each one kind of offers a unique perspective. The table, for instance, gives you precise numerical data. The diagram provides a visual snapshot of the car's location, and the graph shows you the overall pattern of the motion over time.
Right.
Now, here's where things can get a little tricky. They talk about the difference between displacement, which is the change in position, and the total distance traveled. Think about a basketball player running up and down the court.
They cover a lot of ground, but they end up right back where they started.
Exactly. They might run a significant distance, but their displacement is actually zero.
So it's not just about how much ground you cover, it's about where you end up relative to where you began. That makes sense. Now, the next concept, instantaneous velocity. This is where I get a little lost.
Yeah.
I understand average velocity, like the total displacement over time, but how do you measure velocity at a specific moment?
Okay, well, imagine that you're trying to track that car's motion,
Okay.
but you only have snapshots of its position at certain times.
Right.
To truly understand the car's movement, you need more than just the average velocity.
Because it could be speeding up or slowing down between those snapshots, right?
Exactly. You need to know its velocity at any given instant, which we call instantaneous velocity. And this is where calculus actually becomes super helpful.
Oh, calculus, everyone's favorite.
I know, I know. But bear with me. By drawing a tangent line on the position time graph, we can figure out the car's velocity at that specific moment. The slope of that line represents the instantaneous velocity.
So it's all about the tangent.
Exactly.
Okay.
Now, to bring this back to the real world, think about a highway patrol officer with a radar gun. They're not interested in your average speed over your whole trip.
Oh, no, they definitely are not. They care about your speed at the moment that radar gun is pointed at you.
Exactly. That's instantaneous velocity, a very powerful concept. Okay, now that we've got a handle on that, let's talk about a fundamental type of motion called constant velocity. This is when an object moves at a steady speed in a straight line.
So, like a meteoroid just cruising through space far away from any planets or stars,
Yeah.
or a car on cruise control on a perfectly straight highway.
Precisely. No sudden bursts of speed, no changes in direction. And there are special equations that we can use to describe this type of motion.
Okay, so before we get into those, I want to talk about acceleration.
Sure.
You mentioned earlier about seeing those power poles as you're driving and how the time between them seems to decrease as you speed up.
Ah,
That's a
yes.
good way to visualize acceleration, right?
It is. It's all about how quickly an object's velocity changes. But here's the thing. Acceleration isn't just about speeding up.
Oh.
It also includes slowing down or even changing direction.
Wait, so even if I'm maintaining a steady speed, but I'm going around a curve, I'm still accelerating.
You got it.
Because my direction is changing.
Exactly. And since velocity is both speed and direction, if your direction changes, your velocity changes, which means you're accelerating.
Mind blown. I always thought acceleration just meant going faster.
It's a common misconception.
But it's really about any change in velocity, whether it's the speed or the direction or both.
Precisely. And just like velocity, acceleration can be positive, negative, or even zero. Positive acceleration means you're speeding up in the positive direction. Negative acceleration, well, that could mean you're slowing down or speeding up in the opposite direction.
So when I slam on my brakes, that's negative acceleration.
Exactly.
And when I'm merging onto the highway and I hit the gas, that's positive acceleration.
Exactly. Now, to represent all of this visually, there's a cool tool that the chapter talks about called motion diagrams that use a series of dots to represent the position of an object at different points in time.
Okay.
And arrows are used to show both the direction and the magnitude of velocity and acceleration.
So it's like a flip book showing how the motion is changing over time.
Exactly. And by looking at the spacing of the dots and the length and direction of those arrows, you can get a really clear picture of what's happening with both the velocity and the acceleration. Now, a special case that we often talk about in physics is constant acceleration. This is when the rate of change in velocity stays the same over a certain amount of time.
So instead of constantly fluctuating, the acceleration is steady.
Exactly. And just like with constant velocity, we have specific equations that we can use to describe motion with constant acceleration. Hmm. And in fact, this is a situation that comes up all the time in physics.
Like with what?
Well, particularly when we talk about objects in free fall.
Free fall, like a skydiver jumping out of a plane, or like a basketball being thrown through the air.
You got it. And that's what we'll pick up in the next part of our deep dive. We'll be exploring the physics of free fall.
Okay, so free fall. What makes this type of motion so special?
Well, for centuries, people actually thought that heavier objects fell faster than lighter ones.
Yeah.
Kind of makes intuitive sense, right?
It does.
But it was Galileo who really challenged that idea.
Oh, okay.
And his work kind of set the stage for our modern understanding of gravity. Now, instead of dropping objects from, like, the Leaning Tower of Pisa, which is what most people think he did, he actually used inclined planes to slow down the acceleration due to gravity, making it easier to make really precise measurements.
Wow, that's clever.
It was. And what he found was that, neglecting air resistance, all objects near the Earth's surface fall with the same acceleration.
Really?
Regardless of their mass.
That's wild. So if I dropped a feather and a bowling ball in a vacuum chamber, they would hit the ground at the same time.
Precisely.
Mm-hmm.
And this was dramatically demonstrated when astronauts went to the moon during the Apollo 15 mission.
Right.
They actually dropped a hammer and a feather on the moon where there's no atmosphere to slow them down, and they both landed at the same time.
I remember seeing that footage. It's really amazing to watch. Now, when we talk about free fall, does that always mean an object is, like, starting from rest?
Not necessarily.
Yeah.
That's actually a common misconception. Free fall applies to any object that's moving under the sole influence of gravity, no matter what its initial motion is. So whether you toss a ball straight up, you drop it from your hand, or even throw it sideways, as soon as it leaves your hand, it's in free fall.
So all those objects, regardless of how they start, will experience that same downward acceleration due to gravity.
Exactly. And we represent that acceleration with the symbol G.
Yeah.
And it's a fundamental constant for objects that are near the Earth's surface.
Okay. And what is the value of G? Is it the same everywhere on Earth?
It varies slightly depending on things like altitude and latitude.
Okay.
But on average, it's about 9.8 meters per second squared.
So every second an object is in free fall, its velocity increases by about 9.8 meters per second downward.
That's the beauty of it. You know, all those equations that we were talking about earlier, the ones that describe motion with constant acceleration, they apply to free fall as well. Just in the vertical direction instead of the horizontal direction.
So we can use those equations to figure out, like, how long it takes for a skydiver to reach terminal velocity.
Right.
Or how high a ball will travel when it's thrown upwards.
Absolutely. And in fact, the chapter gives some really interesting real-world examples.
Oh, let's go through one.
Yeah.
How about the one with the jet landing on an aircraft carrier?
Ah, yes.
It always seems so intense.
Well, it's a great illustration of how all these physics concepts play out in a high-stakes situation.
Right.
So imagine a jet touching down on a carrier deck at a speed of about 63 meters per second.
That's really fast.
It is.
Yeah.
And it needs to come to a complete stop in a very short distance, usually in about 2 seconds. thanks to those arresting cables on the deck.
Oh, wow. Those cables are really doing some heavy lifting. So how do we actually calculate the jet's acceleration during that rapid deceleration?
Well, we can use one of those constant acceleration equations that we talked about earlier.
Oh, okay.
We know the initial velocity, the final velocity, which is zero because it comes to a stop, and the time it takes to stop. Huh. We just plug those values into the equation, and we can find the acceleration.
I'm guessing it's going to be a pretty big negative number considering how quickly that jet has to slow down.
You're absolutely right. The calculations show that the jet experiences an acceleration of about negative 32 meters per second squared.
Wow. So that's more than three times the acceleration due to gravity. Those pilots must feel some serious force pushing them back into their seats.
They absolutely do.
Yeah.
It's a testament to how well engineered those carrier landings have to be. Now, let's say we wanted to figure out how far the jet actually travels along the deck while it's braking.
So we're looking for the distance it covers during that 2-second interval.
Precisely. And we have another one of those handy equations that allows us to calculate that distance. We know the initial velocity, the time, and now we know the acceleration. We just plug all those values in.
That makes sense.
And in this case, we find that the jet travels about 63 meters before coming to a complete stop.
It's incredible that they can stop a jet going that fast in such a short distance.
It is. That's physics at work. And these principles, they don't just apply to jets landing on carriers. They govern the motion of everyday objects as well.
Right. Okay, that example was really helpful. Let's try another one, maybe one that's a little bit closer to home.
Sure.
How about that one with the speeding car and the state trooper?
Oh, yeah, that's a classic.
Okay, so the scenario is I'm cruising along at a constant speed, let's say 45 meters per second. I happen to pass a state trooper who's hiding behind a billboard.
Uh-oh. Hope you weren't going too fast.
Well, 1 second after I pass the trooper takes off in pursuit.
Right.
Accelerating at a constant rate of 3 meters per second squared.
Okay.
So it's a race against time. How long does it take the trooper to catch up to me?
So this one's a bit more challenging because we have two objects in motion, each with their own set of variables.
Right.
The key here is to figure out when their positions are equal.
So we need to set up an equation where the position of the car equals the position of the trooper.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And to do that, we can use those equations that describe motion with constant velocity for the car and motion with constant acceleration for the trooper.
Mm-hmm.
We know the car's initial velocity, the trooper's acceleration, and we know that you have a 1 second head start.
So we can basically solve for time, and that'll tell us when the trooper catches up.
Precisely. And if we do the math, we find that the trooper catches up to you after about 31 seconds.
31 seconds. That seems like a long time. But I guess that makes sense since the trooper's starting from rest and has to accelerate to catch up.
Exactly. And this really shows how even if you have a head start, constant acceleration can eventually close that gap. It all depends on how long that acceleration is maintained.
So if the trooper had a faster car that could accelerate more quickly, it would take even less time to catch up.
Exactly.
That's a good lesson to keep in mind, perhaps not on the highway, but just in terms of physics. I'm really starting to see how these equations aren't just these abstract formulas. They're actually tools that we can use to understand and predict what's going to happen in real world situations.
Absolutely. And what's even more fascinating is that we can take all of this understanding to a whole new level by actually incorporating calculus into the picture.
Oh, calculus again.
I know. But hear me out. The chapter talks about how we can use calculus to actually derive those kinematic equations that we've been using all along.
Really?
Yeah. Want to see how it works.
Okay, sure. Calculus has always seemed a little bit intimidating, but I'm willing to give it a try.
Perfect. Then let's dive into the world of derivatives and integrals and see how they can unlock even deeper insights into the nature of motion.
Okay, so let's untangle this calculus stuff and how it all ties into the physics of motion. I'm ready to see how derivatives and integrals can enhance our understanding.
All right, well, think of it this way. We've been talking about position, velocity, and acceleration, right?
Right.
As these kind of separate concepts.
Yeah.
But calculus really reveals how they're intimately connected. So velocity, at its heart, is the derivative of position with respect to time.
Okay, so velocity tells us how quickly an object's position is changing at any given moment.
Precisely.
We're talking instantaneous change, not just the average over a period of time.
Exactly. It's like zooming in on a specific point on that position time graph and finding the slope of the tangent line at that point. Mm-hmm. That slope represents that instantaneous rate of change, which is the velocity.
So if we know an object's position as a function of time,
Right.
like how its position is changing over time, we can use calculus to actually find its velocity at any moment.
Exactly. And the reverse is also true. If we know the velocity is a function of time,
okay,
we can use integration, which is the opposite of differentiation, to figure out the object's position.
So differentiation takes us from position to velocity, mm-hmm. and integration takes us from velocity back to position. It's like a two-way street connecting those fundamental concepts.
That's the beauty of it. It gives us a powerful framework for understanding how all of these quantities are related to one another. And the chapter even shows how you can use these techniques to derive those constant acceleration equations that we've been using.
Really? It's like we're looking behind the curtain at the mathematical machinery that's driving these equations. It makes them feel less like magic formulas and more like logical outcomes of those fundamental relationships.
Exactly. It really deepens our understanding. And it kind of highlights the elegance of physics.
Well, this has been an incredible deep dive. We've explored those core concepts of motion from position and displacement to velocity and acceleration. We even ventured into the world of free fall.
Yeah.
And we've seen how calculus provides a powerful tool to analyze all of these ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But before we wrap up, do you have a final thought-provoking question to leave our listeners with? Something for them to kind of ponder as they navigate their physical world?
Sure. Here's one. What would happen if the acceleration due to gravity were different? Imagine a world where g was half its current value or double its current value. How would that affect the way objects move or how they interact?
That's a great question. I mean, would a basketball feel lighter?
Right.
Would it take longer to fall from the hoop to the ground? Could we jump higher?
Exactly. It really makes you appreciate how even a small change in a fundamental constant could have these huge ripple effects.
It's wild to think about. Well, there you have it. You now have a solid understanding of the basics of motion in one dimension, and you've gotten a taste of how calculus can help us unlock even deeper insights. And remember, this is just the beginning of your physics journey. Keep asking those questions, keep exploring, and most importantly, keep those aha moments coming.